Dunia pasca pandemik COVID-19 menyaksikan perpecahan yang besar berlaku bukan sahaja antara negara-negara di dunia tapi sebenarnya juga dalam negara itu sendiri. Dan kita melihat langkah-langkah tidak popular atau populis yang dilaksanakan oleh kebanyakan kerajaan serata dunia mungkin mengundang kesan berantai yang kita saksikan pada ketika ini. Bagaimana untuk kita melihat pemerkasaan kerjasama antara pihak kerajaan dan juga pelbagai segmen masyarakat dalam mengebudi pemulihan ekonomi pasca pandemik COVID-19? Dan sudah pasti ini juga tema yang diangkat di Khazanah Mega Trends Forum 2023 ini, iaitu soal development bargains, yang mana ini diangkat dari penulisan buku Profesor Stephen Darkon sendiri, yang merupakan Professor of Economic Policy Blavatnik School of Government University of Oxford. Dan kita sudah pasti berbesar hati kerana untuk episod pada kali ini Profesor ada bersama dengan kita. Profesor Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Now, you mentioned in your opening speech this morning at Khazanah Mega Trends Forum 2023, you have explained in details about the elite and the expansion of its realm to consolidate the agreement on so-called bargain. Now, I want to look at the world as a whole. The world is changing again right now in the wake of AI and the wave of AI itself. And if I may quote Henry Kissinger in his book, The Age of AI, Generative Artificial Intelligence presents a philosophical and also practical challenge on a scale not experienced since the beginning of the Enlightenment. And as its capacities become broader, they will redefine human knowledge, accelerate changes in the fabric of our reality, and also reorganize politics and society. Now, questions to you, Prof. How to strike this balance whilst even the power of the elite now has been redefined by the wave of tech?
Well, I think to start with, it's probably helpful just to think, you know, well, who will at any moment in time have this power? Mm. Who are the influential groups? You know, and of course there's politics. There's also, of course, business community, those who own the capital. There is also the intellectuals, journalists. And what you allude to, of course, is that their positions may all change. You know, their underlying deal will change with changes in technologies, changes in opportunities.
Yeah.
Although I still, you know, if we look around the world, who controls technology? Hmm. It is either very big business or very powerful governments.
It is, yeah.
Who controls capital to put into it? And, you know, it's not as if all these technologies run on nothing. They require lots of energy. They are requiring lots of capital investment. Hmm. It's still set up the same people. So in the first instance, you know, I don't think it fundamentally changes the role of certain groups, yeah, who, you know, to paraphrase George Orwell, will be a little bit more equal than others. You know, there will be groups that are more powerful that can direct and influence. Now, that's at one level. Of course, AI will change the nature of service provision, the nature of knowledge creation, the nature of how we deal with this. It's going to be amongst those people who have power and influence, it's going to be a challenge for them, you know, and we see this already in certain societies. They try to suppress this, and some try to embrace this. And of course, it will create new forces to come in, new groups that will emerge quite powerful. But I still think it doesn't change this whole thing, that if a society wants to actually progress, it will have to find a way of accommodating those who will control this knowledge, who control the AI technology, who control the companies, the generators, who do this. So they will have to be part of a deal. And even though, you know, maybe new elites will emerge, it's still going to be important that through some forms of cooperation in society, some form of elite consensus between forces in society, that progression will need to happen. And I think, you know, yes, it provides challenges. But, you know, let's go back a step, quite interestingly. I always think, you know, think of the calculator or the Excel sheet. Mm. People were saying, oh my God, this is changing fundamentally. Of course, it changed the way we did business, the way we operated. It's actually about human ingenuity also, how then to put it to use and actually do it. But I do think if we look back over time, there's always certain groups who are the certain power to actually use it more to get most out of it. And we don't want them to stop us from using the benefits from it all. And at the same time, we want to encourage them to try to actually to use it for broader benefits. So still this whole idea that there a deal has to be between all these groups, and even though the power relationships may change, the fundamental need in a society to progress will have to be this deal making between all the various groups.
I understand that fundamental is essentially is intertwined, that you need to work together between all the segments of society, the government and the private sector as well, and the elite as well. But does this mean that the elite in certain countries or certain part of the world, they need to support even the corrupt governments in that sense?
Well, I think, you know, if we observe a corrupt government, it actually is typically part of the elite deal.
Yeah.
And I think I would put it slightly differently.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to start in itself with the word of corruption. But, you know, if we have systems where certain people have more access to jobs or contracts or benefits from the state, it's all part of that deal. You know, it's those people with money that typically shape the state to be like that, so it serves them further. It's those people in politics that encourage a certain set of business to emerge. So I'm not trying to say, so I don't make a statement that I like deeply love the idea of the elite, that I want to embrace them. The way I tend to look at it is that if you look across the world, across societies, there are these groups of people who can either choose to try to keep the status quo, to not try to grow the economy, not to try to make the economy inclusive, and to keep the status quo. And indeed, as you would suggest, to allow corrupt behavior with impunity, to give contracts to their friends and families, and then the families have the jobs in the politics and whatever. So you could have these systems. Or you could actually say, look, yes, be realistic that there will be people that have maybe more influence and opportunities within this society, but we're going to make sure that both we're trying to grow the cake here, grow the pie in this society, and we actually try to make it new, inclusive, because we need a renewal, we need to get new groups to emerge that bring innovation, creativity in the society. Mm-hmm. So I think all these things are actually part of the choices. So if you observe a kleptocratic state, you know, I talked this morning about Congo, where in the end, if you control the state, it seems to have, you have a license to steal from your population. This was definitely the case under President Mobutu, under President Kabila, and probably still even today. You know, that's one way of organizing it. You can go totally the other way and say, look, no, we make it a point, even within the elite, that even if it puts us at risk, we're going to make the state more and more meritocratic. That actually you're getting good positions, good outcomes in the economy because you deserve it, not because you happen to know someone. And that's actually a choice that elites can make in society, actually, to do this. And of course, there's the whole spectrum in between.
You also mentioned and said about the growth. Growth is a choice. And of course, in light of political turmoil in a sense throughout the globe and unpopular steps taken by many governments around the globe and around the world. But how do you foresee these steps and also these choices being made?
Yeah. So look, there's a lot changing in the world. And when I say, and I like to emphasize that it's a choice. In fact, no growth and regression of the economy or stagnation, that's definitely a choice, you know. Especially, I would say, across Asia, where there's still young populations, you know, it's a choice to actually go for stagnation in that respect. And so the related thing is, of course, I'm not trying to say that growth of 15% or 20% per year is a choice.
Yeah.
You know, there are constraints, there are limits to this. Now, that actually links then closely to the way you put your question, because within certain circumstances and an environment, it's going to be very hard for any country now to actually, say, replicate where Korea was 25 years ago or 30 years ago. The opportunities were quite immense. The world was opening up. They were in the right time, the right place. They could have massive growth. In way, China's catch-up growth that we have observed, you know, it's now to a GDP per capita quite similar to Malaysia, but there's a very fast catch-up that it has achieved. It took advantage of opportunities. Now, if you get a world situation, geopolitics, I don't have to explain anything about geopolitics in this country, where it is always a challenge to be between East and West and see where the opportunities lies. Tensions there, actually, in quite a lot of countries where growth has been tempered, whether it's in China or in the West. you know, it's obviously not so self-evident, but it's still a choice to actually say, look, we are not finding the bits of opportunities and actually grow and be efficient in the way we organize our society and our growth, or we actually let it go. So within these constraints, I think, you know, a country like Malaysia has lots of opportunities, yeah. You know, and in fact, smartly playing the game between the superpowers is actually clearly the game that needs to be played. And I know it's being played by quite a lot of Southeast Asian countries. That is actually quite an opportunity, which is not quite an obvious choice, say, for an African country like Nigeria, yeah. Far away from value change, far away from the markets. So there is a lot of opportunities here. And I think, I think you're playing it quite smartly. But it puts a pressure on doing this more efficiently, because the returns to these opportunities are going to be lower, because it's a much more crowded space. Mm. And it again comes back to the national elite bargain, where it actually needs to be much more prudent and much more efficient in the way it organizes both its inclusion but also its stimulus to growth. It can't just be that, you know, there's enough rents and it doesn't really matter, we lose a few percent of growth in the kind of the way we keep it all going. You need to be far more hard-nosed to actually make progress in this particular context.
And what you had hoped to achieve through your research.
So Hakam really wanted the human aspect a bit more than the legal part, which is why they came to a social scientist instead of a lawyer.
What does that speak to you in terms of wanting to do this?
If it's a man so that you are able to allow for some abuse, I totally don't agree with that.
Do we want to kind of restrict the legislative reforms as just one part of the story? The most important aspect for me would be through educational initiatives.
Hai, saya Nella Huda, kakak fiber anda. Dan hari ini saya ada satu soalan nak share dari Aida Bahar. Dia tanya, Wi-Fi cover satu rumah ke? Handphone boleh cover? Dah tentu Astro Fiber dengan router canggih Wi-Fi 6 boleh cover satu rumah, satu family boleh pakai. Bukan saja semua handphone boleh jimat data pakai Wi-Fi, anak-anak nak buat homework online pun senang. Ini ada satu lagi tips jimat kita nak bagi tahu. Bila you nak keluar rumah, downloadlah cerita siap-siap dekat Astro Go app tu. Lepas tu, boleh layan dalam train, dalam kereta, dalam flight. Tak kacau data handphone you langsung. Jimat dah tu, Aida. Ada lagi soalan? Tanyalah. Gunakan hashtag TanyaKakakFiber. Okey?
Could you share the insights of how countries can effectively navigate the dangers of polarized world? You mentioned just now that Malaysia somewhat played smartly to a certain extent, but could you also identify some of the potential pitfalls for Malaysia or the countries alike to ensure the sustained development and also growth moving forward?
Look, the general pitfall, of course, from the way the geopolitics is working is that actually, you know, it is, you know, where we had a period of globalization, actually all the nations engaging it were gaining. Of course, with distributional consequences, and this is clearly where the political backlash has happened in the West.
Yeah.
There's actually middle class and lower middle class people didn't benefit as much. At the same time, it's been the big driver of massive poverty reduction in the world. So the globalization trend played definitely to the advantage of latecomers and emerging markets also like Malaysia. Of course, when the tensions are there and there's actually pressures for deglobalize,
yes.
whether it's one part of the world that plays that game or both parts of the game, of course, the gains from globalization, and even for a country with a kind of living standards as Malaysia, you know, there should have been a lot more rope to actually climb on, and that indeed, say, the Koreas or Japan have been able to do decades back. Now that actually would be harder. So the pitfall is that, you know, the intensity of the way global value chains are organized, it's actually not that self-evident. And of course, the other part of it is that with the kind of wealth and incomes that Malaysia starts having, it can't simply play the game anymore, that it has to be an innocent player in the whole global warming situation and so on. there will be a responsibility as well, and that, you know, yes, you may argue about historical legacies, but probably Bangladesh has more claim to that legacy than a country six times poorer than Malaysia, than actually Malaysia would have. So you have to play your game. So again, you know, these are choices and trade-offs have to be considered. So I think all these things make it a bit harder to actually do it. So it again appeals to, you need to really streamline the way an economy is organized, the way business is organized, the way state-owned enterprises are organized, how subsidies and benefits, patronage and so on are organized, because you know, you can't quite afford to play it easy. You have to be much smarter in that game. Maybe finish a final thing, where I do think Southeast Asia is playing it and can play it, continue to play it smartly, is that of course a relative reduction in acceptance that, say, value chains come entirely out of China. You know, there's a lot of companies on the move as well and looking for investment outside China but staying in Asia. And I'm thinking of Western companies, multinational corporations. And of course there, you know, your locations, your reasonable, although it could be much better, but your reasonable skills levels in this country could play into as well. So there's ways of playing the game, but it is in a situation where global growth will be quite depressed by the kind of geopolitics going on.
You also mentioned in your opening speech about the government needs to have courage in their decision making. If you look at the comparison, for instance, China and India, where the population is almost the same number, but in terms of decision making, China is much stronger in terms of more firm because it's not really as democratic as India, and India is find it hard to make decision because it's a democratic country. You have to go to parliament, and at the end of the day, it's hard for them to make decision. But as the case for Malaysia, different circumstances and also background, for instance, different ethnics and different consideration to be made. How do you see that we can do this in terms of making a courage and firm decision to do something in Malaysia?
Right. So look, you start from the circumstance you have. You know, you can't change your history, so you can't simply want to claim, you know, 2,000 years of centralized administration, 2,000 years of centralized taxation in China, 2,000 years of state building and so on. And, and it's not just about a one-party state. It's actually also a lot to do with, you know, the institutional features that you have. So you can, you know, you have a system where that kind of centralized authority is there. India didn't quite have this. And India, you know, yes, it is democratic, but I don't think that on average it really these days, and we see that in the growth rates of China, of India, it doesn't have to really, it took longer to get somehow to that takeoff, that fast takeoff point, and it's there. What's quite interesting that, you know, if you then also think of China, of India, is that, and maybe to some extent China is struggling a bit with that as well, is, for example, you know, in China it gets reflected in corruption. In India it's also about, you know, somewhat insecure property rights, the court system that doesn't work that well, you know. And arguably you could say maybe Malaysia has an opportunity there not to fall from these pitfalls. But it has to start with its own complicated history and doing that. So I'm actually kind of, it doesn't help to say, I wish I had a centralized authority of China, because you will not have it. That's not part of your social contract, the way your society needs to operate. But it is very striking that, you know, that the nature of the deal making that needs to be done in politics and in the business community, and everybody, as has been repeatedly said at the event here, everybody seems to know each other very well. You know, this is all deep connection and a connected business community also into the politics of the country. You know, it is looking for that kind of brokering, that kind of consensus, and that kind of element of actually work together. So arguably it should be easier than India, where the vastness of the country, the fragmented elite across all the different states and all across the country, maybe a form of fragmented politics that is actually harder to deal with, especially these days, but really fragmented, where you can actually find maybe with a relatively smaller country, a bit easier. Yes, it will never be easy, but determined leadership and determined consensus building will have to be able to say, look, I'm not going to do, I'm giving you a bit and giving you a bit. It becomes a stage where to say, look, in the future, we can all be winners. But we have to be willing sometimes to give some of our interests a bit of a stop, you know, stopping some of our vested interest, some of the patronage we'll have to lower it now because we need to use these resources to invest in the future. And of course, that's still hard. But that's also why the consensus is important. People have to have willingness to be able to see it's not just my enemies that I'm going to make to lose from all this. Yeah. It's my friends as well, and I need to do it. You know, think of it, you mentioned earlier, say, corruption. You know, how do you fight corruption? Is basically, well, you have to do it in a very even manner. You can't simply use it to target your political enemies. And this is way how you make progress, make it a level playing field for different players, and actually say, look, you know, this has to be a bit different. It has to be more transparent, better governed, cleaner in that sense. And that's how you gradually try to create that circumstance. And yeah, you can do it. I have no doubt.
Yeah, Prof, do you believe that certain countries, given their social background, should have somewhat sufficiently authoritarian system in place in order to achieve it?
So my answer is actually quite flatly no. You know, the craving to say we just should have a strong leader and everything will be fine is actually really defeated by the data and by the evidence. Okay, so the point is that many people that raise it, they know the examples of authoritarian regimes that were very successful. They forget, of course, the examples of authoritarian regimes that were quite big failures. Yeah. And in fact, the evidence tells us that on average, autocratic states versus democratic states, in the last 30, 40 years, they performed more or less similarly. Mm. On average, they did. The one thing you have when there is a form of checks and balances in politics as democracy can offer is the spread is less wide. To put it differently, some of the best performers in the economic terms and development terms were autocratic regimes, but some of the worst as well. And democracies, maybe, yes, it's hard to be the very best, but it's actually you avoid being the very worst. And at least you can choose your leaders, so there is an element to that. I think it's much more to do, even in autocratic states, that the best leaders are the brokers. You know, when we think about China, I don't have to tell here that nobody has this fallacy, as I often hear in Europe, where they thought Deng Xiaoping had absolute power. He didn't. He had to get the party on board. Yeah. There were a whole series of people whose names may be less known, but he had to broker a deal. You know, and even a successful autocratic or successful leader in a non-democratic state would have to broker a deal between key stakeholders involved. Yeah. And in China, that was complicated. That's why the reform process was actually quite complicated. So let's not be too hung up the idea a strong leader and everything is fine, because they don't quite exist either in a simple way.
Let's talk about development bargains on the regional level in this region, ASEAN particularly, because ASEAN is regarded as quite neutral to a certain extent. As we see Europe and West focusing more into this region, and we somewhat have to balance our view and in terms of, you know, choosing in terms of side with the US or the China, how do you see the development bargains in the context of ASEAN?
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. I haven't quite worked on it, but there's a lot of people, as you also allude to, see this kind of equivalent there. There's also a kind of a bargain you need to do with the external forces. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so for a lot of the countries that I've studied, it is often the deal to do with, you know, your French or your British colonial masters, how you do it, or maybe during the Cold War, the deals that they had to do, Russia versus the US. And of course, these things mattered. I think here, you know, you obviously have to, and I've kind of alluded to it already, you have to play that game quite carefully. You know, neutrality doesn't really exist. You know, that's a political statement as well. You know, there's this idea that you can do neutral. You know, it is a political statement as well. I think, you know, but you have to also understand that China does what China does in the region, and the West will then also do what the West does. You know, there is an overarching game definitely in the world going on with from a single power essentially to a multi-powered environment, and that of course a multipolar world gives its own challenges, and it gives its, I would also say, its own opportunities.
Yeah.
And my best suggestion would be is that actually for a country to maneuver this is to actually make sure that it's not simply for sale. Okay, there's a lot of deals that, and I will now, you know, despite having worked in the UK government as well, but also say, look, a lot of these deals in the short run feel very transactional. Mm. These are usually not very good deals, whether it's on the Chinese side or on the Western side. I think you want to do an relationship with either, but that has your longer term interest clearly at the center. So if you do economic deals, make sure they don't undermine the business environment, that they don't lead to, say, more poorer governance or more corruption or things like that. If they go into the, but they have a longer term developmental growth perspective in mind. And I think ASEAN countries, clearly each are playing it in a bit of a different way. I think it would be unfair to many of them to say there is a unified way of doing that. And I think you need to find one within your own circumstances. And again, as I alluded to, I don't think Malaysia is playing it very badly. Mm. It's actually playing it reasonably well. Because, you know, we have to be realistic of your location of where you are. And it creates a huge opportunity for you.
Yeah.
But it has to be with the long term in mind.
All right. Prof. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate having you on our show. This is Prof. Stephen Darkon, author and also professor of economic policy at Blavatnik School of Government, University of Oxford. Itu sahaja untuk episod pada kali ini. Saya Najib Arif. Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.